This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Hello again, everybody. This is Martin Spriggs with Wells Tech, show about technology and ministry. This is episode 434, recorded on March 1st, 2016. A little show about technology, ministry, all kinds of things. And this happens to be our education technology focused show. And joining me, as usual, to talk about tech in ed, Sally Draper. Hi, Sally.
Good afternoon, Martin. Happy to be joining you on this first day of March. Comes in like a lion, I hear.
Yeah, God said, how about a little snow today?
Yeah, we got it here too.
Yeah, that's okay. And we're really happy to welcome back one of our semi-regular guests, our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent from way up there in New London, Wisconsin. Hi, Gail. Gail Potratz. Hi.
Hi, everybody. It's snowing up here too, so we're still waiting for spring.
Well, we have high hopes that it will come.
It will come.
Perfect day for a podcast, though, right?
Yes.
And as I mentioned, we're going to talk about technology, education. The kind of genesis or the starter for our conversation today was really a kind of a very in-depth but insightful report, one that comes out every year that I wasn't familiar with until, Sally, you brought this to my attention, the New Media Consortium's Horizon Report for K-12 Education. What's that all about? What's in that document?
Well, just a little background on New Media Consortium. They do a lot of these reports in a lot of different areas where they're looking at the future of technology. And like you said, the one we want to focus on is the K-12 edition, but they actually have reports out there for higher ed, for libraries, for lots of different slices. Vision being looking at trends that would affect educational technology in the K-12 space, you know, things you need to prepare for, stumbling blocks you might encounter as these trends come to fruition. And it's organized in three different sections. Let's see if I can bring that up. There's a section, hang on one second, I can't click and talk. A section of the report titled Key Trends Accelerating Technology Adoption, and then a section Significant Challenges Impeding Technology Adoption, and finally Important Developments in Educational Technology. And all of them are kind of characterized with how urgent they are, how close they are to coming to fruition, that kind of thing. So each one of the articles is a pretty short read, very high level, but gives you plenty to think about and links and things to explore if you're interested in a particular area. There's things about makerspaces, rethinking the role of teachers, the rise of STEAM learning, just kind of all over the board in terms of educational technology.
And one of the particular points that was made in one of the articles was this shift that they're talking about from students, what they called as consumers, to creators. So there's a migration that they're seeing, or that they would hope to see, you know, in our classrooms, in all classrooms, where there's a movement from the student of just receiving information, just consuming information, being a, you know, being somebody that just absorbs it, versus somebody who takes that information and then does something with it, becomes a creator. And that's not a new concept, and I know, Gail, that you've probably thought about this a lot over the course of your teaching career, where you're trying to get students to become more just more active in that educational process and taking what they've learned and doing something with it.
Right, and this isn't anything new, just like you said. It comes through this Horizon report, but if you remember way back when the first ISTE standards came out, before they were really even called that, I think, they had a different name back then, and that was on the end of that first bunch of standards. They talked a lot about collaboration and communication and creativity, and then the next time that set of standards came out, it was just like flip-flop. That moved to the top. It was the top of the list, and that was the focus. And I'm trying to think when that was. I'll try 10 years ago already, but quite a while ago. And so this definitely is not a new concept, and I think it speaks to the idea that it's something that isn't easy to get everyone to implement. It means a shift in a lot of the ways that we typically do school, because it means you're going to be doing more project-based investigation, inquiry-based things, and a lot of that can't be divided into 20-minute sections. You need a good chunk of time. You need to integrate your disciplines together. Oftentimes, it takes a lot of planning and a lot of effort to get these things to happen. So I think in the Horizon Report, Sally, I think you mentioned that this was listed as a 3 to 5 year, mm-hmm. 3 to 5 year goal. So if it's still a 3 to 5 year goal now, and we've been talking about it really for a long time, that must indicate how difficult it is to bring to fruition.
Well, in your experience, and I'm sure you've been trying to push this agenda since you've been in the role where you're at, what challenges have you seen? Why isn't it happening maybe like you'd like it to happen in New London?
I see some very significant challenges, and it's not just here in New London, but the folks I talk to through the MLC classes and, you know, out and about. I really think that in order to make this happen, like I said, it's just not bringing technology into the school. It's a shift in understanding how to do education. It's an educational philosophy shift for people. So there's really two prongs here to this. And number one, I think it all, like everything else, it all starts at the top. So schools that have a strong administration that understands the role of technology in education and what it can mean for the change in education, those schools have a much better chance of progressing further in their use of technology to make learning look a little different at their school. So I think a lot of that comes from the principal or the administrator at the school. You can have a technology director, but there's still that top down, and if the top isn't modeling it or providing time for training for teachers, which is another whole aspect, you know, there's just a lot that ties into the leadership in the school. And as you know, the leadership in our schools wear many hats, so it may not be, you know, it's not that they're trying to ignore this necessarily, but we call on our people to do a lot of things, so it may be hard for them to keep up or to devote the kind of time to it. And not all schools have a technology person even.
Right. So. Don't you think sometimes, or many times, the answer that you hear from schools who are struggling with this is it comes down to budget and money, we just don't have enough?
Well, money can't be ignored. It takes money to buy technology. Honestly, I think it's less of an issue than it used to be in the past. I mean, because now we're using devices that cost less than the average computer used to cost. So if you're talking about implementing one-to-one Chromebooks, and that's a big reason why we have one-to-one Chromebooks, is because the cost is low enough to allow it to happen.
Right.
So the
right.
cost in that sense is coming down. If you use E-Rate to build your network and your wireless stuff in your facilities, that is pouring money out right now. You can get whatever you ask for covered if you, you know, depending on what percentage you qualify to get. So I think the money aspect is not as big an issue as it might have been in the past, mm-hmm. really. I know you still need some, but I don't think it's much of an excuse, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So if the school has an administrator that has that vision, they have the money, or they are able to afford the devices or whatever, I would think maybe one more stumbling block might just be the time investment, because it's not something, well, obviously you've got that tech coordinator or whatever that maybe is setting up the Chromebooks, doesn't take much time, but doing, you know, the infrastructure kind of things, right, or whatever, but it's not just the time of the tech coordinator, it's got to be the time of everyone involved.
Yeah, it's everybody's time. I'm doing technology training after school tonight here, and I have a half an hour during the meeting, you know, and I get a half an hour every month. So that really, some people don't have that, but that really is you know, very little time to move the whole thing ahead. What it really takes is not just working with the technology with the teachers. Very little time do I spend on that. I spend more time on what do you do with the technology, the education part of things, you know. But it takes kind of somebody teaching people in a group, but then the technology coordinator has to have enough time to invest in teachers individually, you know, and go around and actually get into their classroom, talk with them about what they want to do in their curriculum, how they see technology, you know, being a part of it. If they don't have a clue, giving them some choices, you know, this could work, this could work, and let's now I'll help you build a lesson. I'll teach the lesson for you if you want me to,
right.
You know, right. But that's teacher time and coordinator time. You're absolutely right. A lot of this, you know, is stuff that you, if you have a summer schedule that allows for this, we do have a spring and a fall in-service, and then I'm always given, you know, a big chunk of time there on those two ends. But very often that falls to what's new and how does it work. It becomes more of a procedural thing.
Yeah.
And we spend, and I don't think, you know, we're unusual, but it's easy to spend more time in procedural and process things than actual teaching and educational things, and that's scary to me.
Yeah. Sally, can you turn your speakers down a little bit? I'm hearing echo from Gail. Not bad, but so one thing that I kind of inferred from the article, and I think this is kind of a big deal, at least I think it is that this trend really implies that the educators need to be, at least in some ways, creators themselves, so that they're not just kind of thinking about ways that their students can become creators. They have to kind of go through this, almost this evolution themselves. Is that true in your mind?
Yes. It always helps if the leadership is modeling the things that are expected to be learned by other people. And most of our principals, you know, bless them, they're principals, and mostly they're teachers also. I mean, some are just principals, but they're carrying the whole, you know, an educational load for half the day and then an administrative work also. I find that the principals that are good, I mean, many principals are very good at understanding technology and how it can help them in their work. Electronic newsletters, communication things, spreadsheets, surveys, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You know, they can be very good at that, and that serves one niche. But the other thing is, you know, in their classroom, they're oftentimes the one that have the least time to move further with technology in the classroom because they have more work to do as a whole. But yeah, definitely seeing that model, seeing the teacher pick up the laptop and, you know, open it up and have whatever showing up there and being able to use that and be, you know, that's huge.
Well, even if nothing else other than seeing what kind of effort it takes, you know, to create, you know, what is the what is the mental process? How do the tools work? What do you have to bring together? Really hard to teach something without knowing that what the process is to get through it.
Yeah, you know, speaking of,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm curious about your take on one-to-one. It seems like many of our schools are going one-to-one, getting the Chromebooks or whatever devices in the students' hands. I hear about it more and more each day. Is that helping the cause to see these schools implementing Chromebooks in everyone's hands?
It can, certainly, because there's more equipment in more hands. I do have a great fear of the more it comes down to the model, we don't want to just replace what we're doing with something else. We can take notes with a pencil and paper, so now we're taking them on a Chromebook. Is that better? Well, maybe in some ways it is. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. There's the SAMR model, the idea of substitution on the bottom. Are we just substituting a tool for what we could have done in any other way? The idea is we want to move up to redefinition. And, of course, everybody starts at the bottom. Most people start at the bottom and move up in Bloom's taxonomy there. But, yeah, I do fear that. I go by a lot of classrooms, and that the most use I see of them is taking notes, that kind of thing. There's some creation being done as people learn more of what can be done with Google Slides, for example. There's some of that being done. But I do fear that it may not be used correctly. I always, you know, it's before you even get the Chromebooks, does your faculty know what they should be doing with them? Are you teaching them? Are you training them? And if you don't have somebody in your school and they're just buying Chromebooks, what happens with the professional development? Where's that being done?
Sure.
That is a concern of mine. And the whole Google thing, we're a Google app school, and it's got a lot of real positives. I love it. I guess I wouldn't go backwards. But I do think for many schools, including us, that there was a whole time period there where we were kind of sort of moving ahead and up the ladder as far as the level of our technology in our instruction. And then when we had to, well, you know, faculties always shift. People come and people go, and that's kind of starting over sometimes too. The whole idea of having to train people how to actually use Google, that was not an easy thing for a lot of people. You know, they did, and organizing those files and the drive and knowing where everything is and how to, that took a good year and a half to get everybody up to speed, or longer, with just being able to use it themselves, you know, and find their way around in there. And so during that time, they're learning that, and then their kids are kind of sort of learning that. And the whole thing of creation rather than consumption in a lot of set aside.
Yeah, I can definitely.
You know, it is hard.
I can imagine, you know, that concept of the teacher knowing it also kind of takes on another level. So you can get them fairly comfortable, but, you know, you've got to really kind of own it, live it, and then be able to create a vision from it. Not just, you know, the mechanics or the basics, but you've got to live it enough to where you can innovate with what you have. And,
right.
You know, getting people across that bridge has got to be a really big challenge.
The goal is always that the technology can be used seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your goals, you've got your investigation, you've got whatever it is you're trying to create knowledge from and learn from, and produce something that you can share your knowledge then with other people. But, yeah, to get to that point, to get to the top of that peak, is a tough thing. We used to use the Lodi level of technology implementation.
Mm-hmm.
It was when we used it. Now it's the level of something and innovation. They've changed the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't used it now for some years, but it was always kind of frustrating to me because we did it for 5 years, and every year the scores would come out the same. You know, it never... You know, teachers were getting better in personal use of technology, but as far as the best practice for actually educational uses, which isn't to say kids aren't learning how to use a computer, they are, but to learn with it, that was the top goal, and that was a lofty goal the way that thing was set up. But yeah, it was mighty hard to get people to move up a step, you know. Again, time and effort and learning. I think the technology person can't be the only one that goes to workshops or goes to school. You know, I'm always trying to send people to things, CISA workshop or whatever, you know. And for whatever reason, not a lot of people like to leave their classroom.
Well, I think it gets down to that time thing. You know, then every minute they're not there, you know, they feel they're getting a little bit further behind in prep.
It takes 2 minutes to get that 1 minute. Yep, I agree.
Exactly. Do you think that because of the new generation kind of having an embedded understanding of technology, just because it's in the school that they go to, we know it's kind of growing at MLC and becoming part and parcel to it. They use Google Apps, so that whole learning curve, that part of the learning curve is not an issue. So they're coming into the field with a little bit better foundation, maybe. Now, they're not going to have any more time than anybody else on staff, but do you think the fact that they've got some of the basics down already maybe would open up the door to kind of expand into other areas here that we're talking about, some of these, you know, taking some of these trends and doing something with them? Or, you know, are we going to have to wait till curriculums kind of catch up with us as well? I mean, I think we're still probably dealing with curriculums that aren't where this thinks we should go either.
Right. I love what MLC has done recently. I mean, we get student teachers every year, and it's only been the last couple of years, you know, because I grill them. What do you know about this? What do you know about that? Mm-hmm. And, the two gals we had this year were really so well-versed, and they got the whole Google thing going on now, which I think is very helpful if they're using that there. And I know they have iPads and they have Chromebooks and, you know, tools so that the kids, before they come out in the teaching field, have an exposure at least to the various devices and the process it takes to use them. I know less about what's going on in the actual educational part at MLC, you know, the core courses. That would be the thing. I would assume that as time has gone by, more professors would be comfortable with that themselves, and they could, talk about in their classes the use of technology in their particular curriculum, their discipline, you know, because that is where that would be really great. And I don't know how much of that does happen because I don't have enough knowledge of their, you know, what's going on there. But hopefully that is, you know, getting better and better. And that's really what it takes, is when you have somebody with an educational background that gets how to use the technology with it. So,
and maybe over time we'll have more and more examples like that of innovative things to not only, you know, model it, but also maybe light a little fire or put a little bit more impetus behind the efforts to do that kind of innovation, that kind of redefinition of learning.
Sure. And look at the online courses that come out of MLC now that include technology in them, you know. So the the classroom teacher, you know, can go back and take those as well as the, you know, the graduate course level courses that they offer in education and in technology. I think have become stronger and stronger as time goes by, and that will only continue to get better. So, more of our in-service teachers could take more advantage of some of those things, too, that are out there. And the graduate students, I just know from my experience with the class that I teach there, I have the graduate students and the college kids in the same class, and it's been a slow, I mean, I've done it enough times now to see the change in the college kids that are taking the course are much stronger in technology and education. So they must be getting that there because that's where they're going.
Right.
And I do see a great improvement there. So that's very encouraging.
Encouraging, yeah. So if there is a teacher or a staff or an administration that wants to take this to heart and do something, go somewhere, be where this is suggesting classrooms should be or will be, what do they do at this point? How can they, are there tools, are there processes, are there, how would you maybe advise or counsel them?
Boy, that's a great question. Wish you'd have given me that one to think about earlier, Mark.
How do you solve all the problems, Gail? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, certainly, like we just mentioned, there are courses through MLC. There are also courses in your local area, depending on where you live, the CESA, and I can't even remember what it stands for. I don't know if that's just a Wisconsin thing. It's areas, public schools are, the state's divided up into areas. I can't remember what the acronym is, but they produce, I get things that come across my desk all the time from them. They teach how to use iPads in education. They teach how to use Chromebooks. They're focused on technology. They also have things about discipline or, other management, other teacher kind of related things, but very heavy in the last, 15 years on the technology. And if you're in Wisconsin, you're close to one of those, even if you're not close. Ours is close, so we're fortunate there. But you can get money from the title monies that will even pay for your teachers to go there. So, and I think any most things related to technology, there's a lot of funding for that through title programs. And again, I know Wisconsin, I'm not that familiar with the other ones, but I would assume they have something similar. So if you're worried about funding, schools can't always afford to send people to places, which is another thing, that's another show. But, really, we have to have money. We have to be able to spend what it takes to educate our people if we expect them to be, current with the philosophies that are out there about education and technology. So
professional development, and not just for the technology guru, but across the board, teacher professional development in this
right.
space, and that'll give them exposure to some of those best practices and innovation yeah. that's going on out there.
I mean, schools can always, they just look for people who might know something. I mean, mm-hmm. I've gone to many number of schools, and tried to go for a 3-day workshop with their faculty or whatever and try to build some of this into them. And so I'm sure there's plenty of people in our own circles that, if you would call them and ask them, they would probably be happy to do that. It's usually a summer kind of thing because of the time frame again. But I think we do have a lot of resources within ourselves, too. if you ask somebody who's good at technology, and of course, it's not just technology, like I've been saying all along, but, there's some people, plenty of people within our system that probably could be tapped, too.
Speaking of examples and innovation, there's a good example or many good examples in that Horizon Report article. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. One that they brought out was MathTrain.tv, and it's basically students screencasting and teaching other students math concepts. And so you can find all kinds of videos and audio and podcasts done by this middle school group in a Central California, I believe, is what this is out of. They also link to Common Sense Media. We've talked about that before on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And Common Sense Media actually has a whole section dedicated to educators, including under their digital citizenship link, an entire curriculum that they've set up where you can look through the scope and sequence and see something for pretty much every grade level, K through 12, different lessons linked to and addressing different types of training and lessons that you can use in your classroom. So if you're looking for some curriculum resources, that's a good place to start. They also have a whole section dedicated to one-to-one and kind of walk you through implementing a one-to-one program with different phases of your implementation, from surveying all the way through teaching with it. So lots of good resources out here on Common Sense Media, in particular in their educators section. So just a couple to get you started. Gail, you had an example that you shared with me before the show of one of your literature projects that you did with your students there in New London.
Yeah, this is just an easy thing you can do. Like when you do a flipped classroom type lesson, you don't always have to create your own stuff, although it's getting easier and easier to do that. But oftentimes you can find things, and there are websites out there that have these things for you. So it was on what is a plot diagram. I wanted the kids to understand what you could do with a plot diagram and a story. So this is old stuff. This is still a wiki that I have this on. I've never updated it, but I use it every year. They go to the movie, the little video plot structure. Some teacher talks about plot structure, and he uses this goofy-looking park bench thing as his background. And then, so the flipped part is, it's right off of the Flipped Learning Network Education TV. So you can find all kinds of videos in there that you can use for flipped classroom. And then, so the kids watch this little video, and I have some other instructions I send them online. They have to find out two other words that sometimes I use for names, for types. Sections of the diagram, and then that's their work they do on their own. And then when they come to class, we get out the iPads and we actually do a plot diagram, and they tell me about what all the parts are and the purpose. It's pretty nice to start the short story unit that way, because we refer to that a lot. And they put a crazy picture. They find a boomerang or a roller coaster or something, like the guy had the goofy park bench. And so they synthesize their knowledge from the video and from the internet, and they put it together in a creative piece that shares their knowledge. And that's just, I mean, we're not talking about, everything doesn't have to be a 45-day, you know, fully invested thing. This is like a one class period thing. And those are the easy ones to do. You know, you can adapt a lot of this to lessons you already teach and just teach them a different way, where the kids end up creating something to share.
That's awesome. Thanks for being an innovator and a leader. Yeah. Hopefully, this podcast can allow others to share those kind of projects as well. So if you've done things like that, that would be neat for you to share links to different projects where students are creating.
You talked about the math TV. This project that we just talked about, we used Explain Everything on the iPad. There's an app called Explain Everything. And there's also an app called Show Me. And either one of those are great for allowing kids to talk about something while they're showing you. So they're drawing the plot diagram, or they've pre-drawn it. They've got it all set. And then they turn on the recording. They talk about it. They illustrate with the teleprompter. They're circling things and speaking to them. And those are two great iPod apps that are very handy when you're trying to get kids to create something to show and share knowledge.
Sure.
Very good. We could probably talk for another hour or so just on this topic. There's a lot of opportunity for growth. I think my biggest takeaway, as I look at the schools that I've consulted with and even the congregations that I've worked with, is that technology can't just be one person's job or one person's job title. We have to get beyond that compartmentalized approach to technology. It's not a subject. It's something that overlays everything that is going on these days in some way or another. And until we kind of get that understanding and get that structure set up in our organizations, in our churches and schools, it's going to be a challenge. So let's move on to our news and tech section. And Facebook's in the news.
It is. I actually have a couple of articles to link to in our show notes. This one from Mashable, and it's all focused on Facebook's reactions. If you're seeing my screen, you can see that you don't just have a thumbs up like anymore. You can love something. You can actually be sad about it or surprised about it. They've attached emojis to the like icon. And if you're on a desktop and you click on the like icon, then you get these pop-up emojis. I should probably show it on our Wells Tech Facebook page. That'd be a great place to demonstrate it. So if you wanted to like our article, just waiting to scroll down just a little, perhaps this post about the photo challenge might be one you'd want to like. When you click on like, and maybe I should do it as myself instead of Wells Tech. When you click on the like icon, that's when you get the pop-up, and you can like, love, laugh at, say wow, be sad about, or even angry in reaction to a particular post on Facebook. And so the article from Mashable actually walks you through some different things. It's a little tricky on your phone. They tell you how to do it on your phone. You have to click and hold your finger on the icon to make it happen on the phone, and they show you an example of that and things. So a few tricks there around that. And then a little bit of a reaction from Wired Magazine. They have an article here about how advertisers don't like Facebook's reaction. They love it. And that advertisers now are going to be able to get better feedback on the things that they're sharing via Facebook. And this just made me think that churches and schools will be as well, able to gather better feedback about things that you're putting out there. And so you can dialogue further or refine your message and, you know, in whatever way is appropriate depending on what the reaction is. So a change for Facebook. It's not just like anymore. It's actually react is the new verb that they're using there.
So are you limited to those six or seven that they have there at this point? It's not like an emoji list per se like you'd have in your text messaging app?
That's correct. There's those six or whatever it is. I'm trying to click and get it to come up again for me on Facebook. And there's not a thumbs down, a dislike. I know a lot of people along the line have said they'd like to dislike things, and they didn't add anything like that. But you can be sad about it or angry about it. I guess that's their effort there. So that's what they gave us to deal with, and we'll see how it goes. One more thing. I probably should share my screen. If you see that people like your post, and it's perhaps a mixture, let me just get my screen share back up here, a mixture of likes and dislikes or whatever, when you bring it up, they actually tally it along the top. And so in this case, four people liked the post, and you can see over their little icon a blue thumbs up. But if there were some loves, you'd see a red heart, and you'd see a count of how many people love the post up here or were sad by it or whatever. So you aren't just kind of oblivious to the different layers of reacting. You can open up that list and see the counts for the different things there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to more news. This is Wells News, and speaking of trying to figure out how to use technology, we have a entry in that category.
Actually, yeah, Gail, you did a great lead-in for this. Martin Luther College does have an educational technology certificate, and it allows you to work towards different goals. There's kind of different strands that you can take and get an educational technology certificate. So perhaps you aren't up for a full-blown master's degree, but you'd like to bone up on your educational technology skills. Check out the educational technology certificate. There's an application here. There's an FAQ about it in your program plan and things like that. And you can learn more about the program, you can get up to date on your skills, and you get a nice certificate when you complete it.
Good stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it's time for our picks of the week. Guests always first. Gail, you have a pick this week?
I do. I'm going to have to share my screen here first. And come on.
I see. Okay.
All right. So I'm going to go over here to actually, oh, that's not it. Okay. And get my link, or maybe not. I'm going to get my link right off of the map here, Sally.
Oh, you can do it. Yeah. I might have to right-click to open it or something. I'm not sure.
All right. Let's look. All right. All right. I want to talk today about Eric Kurtz, who is an internet friend of mine. We've never spoken, but I follow him on Google+. There's a place you can learn a lot of stuff. And he is speaking about creative ways to use Google. I have done two of his things with the kids lately, and they've been great. He's talking in this section about comic strips. So I have to first show you his sample that he shows. Why would you ever want to use comics, have your kids create comics? Well, you can use comics to illustrate a concept from class, such as a property of science, which we'll talk about here. Students could retell a portion of a literature story. I've done that one. They could reenact a famous scene from history. They could tell about themselves, make an autobiographical comic at the beginning of the year. Or you could even use your vocabulary words and make a comic out of them. There's tons of ways you could do this. So his example is robot and penguin science concepts. And if you look at the next page, he has them come in and, hey, penguin, what are you doing? Just studying. You guys can probably figure out the answer to the comic already. Mm-hmm. Why do you have a book on your head? Obviously, it's for science class, so I thought osmosis would work. Mm-hmm. And there is then the definition of osmosis. So you could take your science concepts for the unit and everybody could pick one and they could design a comic around it to further reinforce the concept. And you could give some directions how they have to end with a definition and whatever. But he goes through how to do a comic, and so that's really what I linked to here is his whole spiel, because there's a lot in here. But if you just click on this and watch his video, he goes through, and this could be for the very new user of Google Slides. You know, people use them and use them kind of like PowerPoint. Well, you can use text boxes to do all kinds of things and backgrounds and shapes. And he describes how to do this and how to lay out a comic, as well as where to get your graphics that you use in the comics. Clipart.org, I think it is, clipart.org, has a lot of index, and that you can find your characters there. And he gives some very practical and very easy-to-use tips on how to use Google Slides creatively to produce a comic. So I thought this was worth sharing. It was something we tried. And the kids picked one of the short stories that they had read, and they didn't have to do the whole story. They just had to do a significant part to show something. They don't know that I'm really going to use this for something better later, but mm-hmm. that was just practice. But any number of them did the whole story because they just loved doing it, and they turned out really nice. The kids that put a lot of thought and time into it had some really cool ones. So I'm sure they will not forget those stories anytime soon.
So did you have the kids do them in teams, or this is an individual activity?
This one they did on their own. Okay. There was one that I allowed to do a team because they wanted to do the whole story. And so I said, okay, if you do the whole story, you can take two of you. But some of them did the whole story on their own, too. So.
Neat.
Yeah, it was very cool. So anyway, I thought he's great. He's a great guy to follow on Google+. And very good for beginning teachers. So you can start with any faculty that knows what Google Slides is, and they could learn how to do this. And that's what we're going to do tonight at our in-service. So I hope that's true.
Good luck with that. Sounds fun. I like that keyword creating there, just like the Horizon Report
said. That's right. It's all about creating. Yep.
That's awesome.
All right. Sally, you're up.
My turn, huh? I actually have something to share that I read about in a Google newsletter recently. They were sharing the Matific website and Chrome plugin. So this is something that would work on Chromebooks, I believe.
Matific, is that how they're spelling it?
Matific, yes, okay. Sir, Matific.com. And you would probably pronounce that differently. I don't know.
I have no idea.
Okay. My pastor was reading a long list of Bible things and said, if you do it with confidence, that's all that matters. You can be believable. So I don't know if that's always true on this podcast, however, but we'll move on from pronunciation issues to talk about math, which is really fun. The website is set up for grades K through 6. It has these interactive activities. So you click on something and a little screen pops up. This one in particular is about totaling up cards to match 10. So if you were to click on one card and then the card, this card only has one item on it, this card has 9 items, they match up to add up to 10. This one with 3 and this one with 7 and then 2 and 8. So helping the students learn to count and add with these interactive activities. Matific is a free trial for teachers, and somewhere I read that it was $10 per student per year, but I can't seem to find that information on their website. As a parent, you can get a free trial, and then it's $3 to $6 per month, depending on the length that you sign up for access. So definitely a fee-based website, but it looks like it's very well done. As I said, there's a Chrome app for it. And then there's also mobile apps. I noticed on their homepage that they have an app in the iTunes App Store as well as the Google Play Store. So looking for some fresh math activities for your students, look no further. Try out Matific.
Very nice. My pick of the week has everything to do with something that's been in the news a lot lately, and that is security. And I've talked about how to use two-factor or multi-factor authentication for your logins before, and in that context, I was talking about Google Authenticator. This is a similar product. It's got a couple of benefits over Google Authenticator. For one, it's totally cross-platform, and it'll even work on the desktop. But it is a very similar product. It's called Authy, Authy.com. And one of the advantages it does have is that it could be used for businesses or organizations. So you could roll out the tool, whether on a computer or in a mobile environment, to all the employees, etc. Or it has a product just for individuals, and that's the one that I've been using for a little bit now. It is really simple to install. So basically the way it works is you install the app, and then you go to the applications that you want to enable two-factor authentication for. So let's say you go to Facebook, or you go to Dropbox, or you go to LastPass, or anything that supports two-factor authentication, Amazon, Gmail, all of those support two-factor. So you have to find where it is in the application that you set that up. But what happens is once you set it up, at some point during the process of enabling two-factor authentication, they're going to want you to scan a barcode. And that's where Authy jumps in. So you open up the Authy app, you hit scan the barcode. So you're going through a little wizard there as well. You just point it at your screen. It uses a camera on your smartphone, for instance. And it immediately recognizes, hey, I know that, and I know that provider. So if it's Dropbox, it says, well, I can add a authentication code for Dropbox. And then what Dropbox will do while you're scanning the barcode is it'll pop up a little box and say, enter this 6-digit number that Authy is going to provide you. So that's the two factors. So not only do you enter a password to get into Dropbox, but now you enter this code that only is available on a device that is in your hand, your cell phone typically. You can also get some of these providers to send you text SMS messages with the code as well, but I think this is a little bit more secure. So that can be a pain, although what happens over time is you can say, remember the device that I'm on, and then for 30 days it won't nag you again. This is just kind of an extra layer of protection. So even if your password gets hacked, wherever that may be, somebody could not go into your Facebook account and basically steal it from you without having your phone with them as well, because the authentication, Authy in this case, is the only one that knows that number. There are a number of these providers. This happens to be a very popular one right now because it does basically everything Google Authenticator does, but does it cross-platform, does it on the computer themselves, and very clean interface, easy to use. It just kind of sits in the background until you come across a website. Let's say you're logging into Facebook 31 days from now, and it's going to say, well, it's about time for you to authenticate, and it'll say go to your app and just plug in that 6-digit number, and you're good to go. They have all kinds of other products that are more business focused. This is free to use. I think extremely well done, very easy to use, and probably a great idea for anybody that is using social networks or uses cloud storage even. One of the most sensitive things that you probably have is your email. So if you're a Gmail user, you probably don't even realize how many really private things go through email. And they can, anybody with that key to your Gmail account or email account probably could get all kinds of information about you that you wouldn't want to make public. So this helps out with that kind of thing. So Authy, AUTHY.com, give it a try. Or if you don't like it, use Google Authenticator or one of the others that are available out there. But seriously consider turning on that two-factor authentication feature that is available in almost every mainstream product these days.
Great recommendation, Martin. Your last comments about being a Gmail user reminded me of something I just read over my lunch break. It came from our friends at The Guru. They're all about Google products over at The Guru. And they said that, unbeknownst to me, Gmail uses some security around sending emails. It'll scan your emails to see if it has private data like social security numbers and credit card numbers, and it won't send those. It kind of protects you from doing stupid things, I guess, in that regard. And the news was that now it's also able to read images with that same security technology. So if you have some image in your email that has your social on it or whatever, it very likely will stop you from sending that as well.
So. I've not seen that. Not that I've tried to send my social security number or credit card number, those kinds of things, which you should never do over email since it's totally unsecure. I'd like to see how that works. That's a great feature.
Yeah, definitely. Good news for us.
Good. Shall we move on to ministry resources?
Yes. This one came to my attention through Bible class. So a quick shout out to all those pastors in our audience who regularly provide Bible study, prepare and present Bible studies in their congregations. In our congregation, St. Paul's in New Ulm, it's a large congregation, and we're blessed to be here at the foot of the hill that houses Martin Luther College. So we have a lot of professors, pastors in our Bible classes regularly, and they do some trade-off at times with who's leading Bible class. So recently, Professor Lawrence Olson from MLC was leading Bible class at St. Paul's, and we've been doing a long study on 1 Samuel. We're fixing to move to 2 Samuel, but it's been really interesting, exciting stuff there in the book of Samuel. Anyway, he used this video. It's out on YouTube. It's from a group called Jelly Telly. I'd never seen these videos. And this is actually the Sunday school lady who's explaining 1 Samuel, a little cartoon format, but a very good overview of the historical, you know, scenario around the book of 1 Samuel and things that were going on at that time and that kind of thing. So I was quite impressed with Jelly Telly. Jotted it down. Books of the Bible, 1 Samuel was the one that he shared. Found the Jelly Telly YouTube channel, and they have a lot of things out there. They actually have a website where they for sale give you access to videos, kind of a concept like a Netflix or something, but with a Christian audience, you know, appropriate for Christian children in mind. But I loved it in an adult Bible class, so maybe you would enjoy some of the videos yourself as an adult as well. But certainly one to put in your ministry resources toolbox, and check out Jelly Telly if you're looking for some fresh explanations to include in some presentations or Bible classes that you're preparing for.
Neat. I had never heard of them either, and I know I was noticing that video that you were showing was, I think, 2009 it was.
Yeah,
posted, it was, so they've been around
they've
a
been
while.
Around for a while. But they've got some fresh stuff out there, too. Some of their videos have, you know, million views and things, so they've got some exposure and a big subscriber base and everything.
Great, great ministry resource. Mm-hmm. Speaking of video, we have a featured video this week, too.
We do, a little bit of a story behind it. It's not an action-packed video, but more like a music video. We were tipped off to this from our friends over at Bread for Beggars, breadforbeggars.com, and they oftentimes will highlight great music and other videos on their website. This one is from musician Joey Schumann, who's a Wells guy, and he has recorded a beautiful version of If God Himself Be For Me. And there's a little article there that talks about you know, his reaction and as people are discovering the music and things. And I think it's a great listen, and we'll have that video embedded on our show notes webpage.
Very nice. That's going to about do it for this week. I'm looking forward already to next week, Sally. We've got Amanda Molstead coming on the show to talk about a very neat memory system, a catechism memory system. So she's going to explain how she and her husband kind of came up with the idea with some help from other members in their church called On My Heart. It's a memory work system that I think you'll want to see. And we're just going to talk about growing your faith digitally. Lots of tools out there today to help grow your faith, from electronic catechisms to Bible information classes to all kinds of stuff with Bibles and note-taking, those kinds of things. So that is going to be the topic next week, so I hope you'll tune in for that. Gail, really appreciate you coming on again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Always fun.
Mm-hmm. Great topic, deep topic, I think gave us a lot of things to think about. If you'd like to contribute to the show, listeners, you can easily do that by going to our show notes page, wellstech.wells.net. sending us an email, wellstech@wells.net. Before I forget, just a little reminder, we've for many years had a mailing list, listserv we call it. The Wells Tech listserv has about 500 subscribers on it. That is being decommissioned. So this week, you're listening to this probably the first week in March. You, if you're already a subscriber, will be getting an invitation from us to join a Google group. So we're migrating our listserv, which is on a little bit older technology that we really don't want to maintain anymore, to Google group, which will give us some added functionality and ease of maintenance. So you'll get an invitation. Go ahead and accept that invitation, and then we'll let you know here pretty quick in the next few weeks that we're shutting down that listserv, and we're going to try and migrate all the old conversations over so those don't go away. But you'll be getting a new email address, so it'll be wellstech@groups.wells.net. So look for that invitation, accept it, and then continue that Wells Tech chatter on the Wells Tech Google group. So watch for that in the next few days. As always, thanks for joining us, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.